Wow.
The cyber jail, the cyber jail itself. And so, they have to do something. And we're trapped, not ready to say nothing.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us this evening. I'm Paul Holtzman, a member of the Newton Human Rights Commission. I want to welcome you to this evening's discussion. And I would like to thank the Newton Free Library and Director Kathy Glick-Weil for help and cooperation in putting this evening's program together, and thank the folks from the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School for their technical assistance in putting together what I think will be a really interesting live demonstration of some of the Internet issues that we're going to be discussing. I'll turn the program over to Murph Shapiro, who is the principal of the Oak Hill Middle School, who's going to be one of our panelists this evening and will be moderating the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to the evening. The whole issue of the Internet and technology is, to me, a very important issue, and one that often we as adults are a few steps behind kids on, and whatever we can do to catch up or get a little bit closer. Well worth our while. On the panel tonight is Lauren Levin, who is the Eastern State Civil Rights Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League. And Lauren will show us a filter that the ADL has for the Internet around hate sites, so we can talk a little bit about that. And Jonathan Zucker, who is the Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. And Jonathan will talk a little bit more about filters and different ways that parents and others can keep themselves protected from various sites on the Internet. So we'll begin the evening with Lauren.
Hi, thank you. And I'm going to begin the evening by introducing a video that we have. The ADL has just recently, a couple of months ago, released a filter. And this, it's a hate filter for use by parents to filter out hate sites on their home computers. For use by their kids. We do not, the agency does not endorse this product for schools, or we're not marketing it for schools or libraries because of First Amendment concerns. But we have a brief video that shows some hate sites, and it's just 5 minutes, and it'll give you an overview of the issue.
The Internet, a software program called the Anti-Defamation League Hate Filter,
a product that parents can choose to install on their computer in order to keep messages of hate, bigotry, and violence from reaching their children. To understand why this product is needed, let's look at the Internet.
As the Internet becomes our new town square, a computer in every home, a teacher of all subjects, a connection to all cultures, this will no longer be a dream, but a necessity. And over the next decade, that must be our goal.
This message, which was broadcast live in video, is both an emblem of the growing power of the Internet and a vision of its future. Information and entertainment accessible in a moment from anywhere in the world in the privacy of a room, a kid's room, any time of the day or night.
Greetings, my Aryan brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Alpha website.
Or this collection of colorful, animated, anti-Semitic hate from a site called Holy War. This less colorful, pernicious site features the full text of a book repeating one of the oldest and most malignant anti-Semitic slanders, the blood libel, the myth that Jews kill Christian children to use their blood in the making of Passover matzahs. Anti-black racism also flourishes on the net. This neo-Nazi anti-Semitic racist skinhead site from the so-called World Church of the Creator, with its notion of racial holy war, visually glorifies hate-driven violence. Homophobia, too, is online. The site name speaks for itself. This group, as the front page for mid-October 1998 indicates, picketed the funeral of Matthew Shepard, the Wyoming college student, brutally murdered because he was gay. This hate site urges white men must arm and provides a list of needed military equipment and links to online sites selling this material. It also has formulas for homemade explosives. The introduction to the formula list disingenuously points out that many of the recipes it provides produce materials that are illegal and dangerous to make. But it tells the reader the needed chemicals will probably have to be stolen, and suggests school chemistry labs as a likely source for materials. Happy hunting? Happy hunting indeed. Here, a Klan site voices the vigilante history of the Klan. The message scrolling at the bottom says, the Klan is watching you and doesn't like what it sees. Another Klan site prominently features the noose of the lynch rope. Some online haters have tried to give hate and themselves a new, more respectable face. Here, ex-Klan leader turned politician David Duke.
This is David Duke of the David Duke International Internet Radio Broadcast.
Uses the broadcast capabilities of the Internet, trying to create a worldwide radio network on which to spread his message. Even before Duke, Don Black, another ex-Klan leader, started Stormfront, possibly the best-known hate site on the Internet. Black, too, has tried to renovate the image of hate, hiding it behind a mask of ethnic pride and so-called white nationalism. But his site is a hub linking the user to dozens of racist anti-Semitic sites. From Black's page, a user can, with just a mouse click, go to sites filled with racist music. Hate such as this, easily accessible and designed to appeal to youngsters, raises a challenging question. What can be done about hate on the Internet? Our American traditions and laws protect almost any kind of utterance on the Internet, no matter how distorted, no matter how hate-filled. But parents are justifiably concerned. ADL has monitored and reported on the growing phenomenon of hate on the Internet in our print publications. Our goal is to inform and educate the public about how and why this new medium had been seized upon by the haters, to counter bad speech with good speech. Suggesting that something very problematic is on the requested pages. But HateFilter does much more than that. Hate Filter adds a feature not found in any other product. It doesn't simply block access to hate. Hate Filter provides a link to the ADL site, where a child can find information about hate and hate groups. ADL has fought hate for more than 85 years. It brings enormous expertise to identifying and providing information about haters and hate groups. The sites that are blocked are based upon the total content of the site and not on keywords. How does the product work? Imagine this scenario. A child is given an assignment to find out about the Holocaust. At home, the youngster turns on the family computer, goes to the internet, and decides to look for information using Yahoo, the leading search tool on the internet. The child types in Holocaust, then clicks on the first Holocaust link. The child is given a group of choices. Suppose he or she picks revisionists, one of the main choices presented on this page. The youngster now has a list of sites from which to choose and scrolls down to look at them. Suppose the child clicks on the Zundel site. Here the child encounters Holocaust denial up close and personal. Denial is the latest variation in anti-Semitic propaganda. The deniers claim the Holocaust never happened. Following a link on the front page brings the young researcher to this, quote, "The linchpin in this argument is simply that there were no gas chambers, none, zero, nada. There is no evidence of gas chambers that an objective person can find credible," unquote. In a nutshell, according to the deniers, the Holocaust is a lie. What is a child to make of such material? Can a child determine that the claims are a series of lies and distortions? That this material is a blatant attack on Jews and a defense of Hitler and the Nazis? Hate Filter counters this. To see how it works, let's retrace the process, but with one additional step. This time, the parent has decided to download and install ADL Hate Filter on the family computer. And now, let's repeat the search. The child types Holocaust, accepts the first response, clicks on revisionists, scrolls down to the Zundel site, and clicks. This time, instead of going to the Zundel site, the child is told that this choice would bring him or her to a hate zone. Access is restricted. This process happens on the computer he or she is using. But instead of simply being stopped, the child has a choice. Use the back button to go back to Yahoo and find a site that is not loaded with hate. Or go to ADL to find out why access has been blocked. On the ADL site, the child finds a menu of choices about different types of hate. For example, Holocaust denial. Here, the youngster gets information about why that site was blocked, information that helps him or her to understand what makes a site such as the Zundel site a hate-filled, anti-Semitic place on the internet. But the youngster can also get information about other types of hate, anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, as well as groups such as the Ku Klux Klan that promote this social poison. Hate Filter is available on the Anti-Defamation League website at www.adl.org. At this location, parents can get information about Hate Filter, answers to questions they have about the product, instructions about how to get and install Hate Filter. Anti-Defamation League Hate Filter acts as a crossing guard on the information superhighway, alerting children and parents to the dangers of hate-filled extremism on the World Wide Web. Anti-Defamation League Hate Filter counters myth with fact, hate with tolerance, bad speech with good, keeping children out of the hate zone.
Stated the challenge that is before us when he sent us some material in the mail. And what he stated was, quote, "How do we combat the rise of the use of the internet to spread messages of hate without encroaching on the right of free speech and academic inquiry?" There are two types of hate on the internet. What you've just seen, our filter product, is really designed to filter out extremist groups' use of the Internet. By this, I mean organized hate groups such as Holocaust deniers, neo-Nazi skinheads, white supremacists. The second type of hate on the Internet that's out there is individuals who use the Internet to spread hate. For instance, hate-filled electronic messages that are sent among students in a school or a work or individuals in a workplace or home computers, hate websites that are established by individuals, or hate messages that are sent in chat rooms or instant messages. The video, I think, did a good job of describing to you some of the main hate groups that are out there. The Internet has definitely become the weapon of choice by many of the haters in America. We've seen that these hate groups have sharpened the rhetoric, that there's been an increased actual fundraising and ability to fundraise. Many of these groups sell hate stickers, t-shirts. They specifically market items on their Internet sites to young people. The best known users are the Holocaust deniers that we talked about. Don Black, Operation Stormfront, is one of the most sophisticated. You saw how he has interactive sites, how he can link you onto other sites. He can actually, you can download white supremacist music, and you can also download symbols. The second type of hate, to me personally, is a far greater concern, because I believe the second type of hate is something that each person in this room can do something about. And the second type of hate deals with the individual's use of the Internet. And I'd like to give you three examples of what I'm talking about. The first, a 14-year-old boy receives a threatening hate-filled electronic messages from his classmates on his computer at home. He ignores it. Finally, he becomes so concerned he tells his mother, but he begs his mother not to tell the school officials. Subsequently, his classmates go so far as to establish a web page making fun of the youngster using crude sexual jokes, jokes about his sexual orientation. Finally, the boy says to his mother that it's okay to speak up to school officials. In a second case, a student at a local prestigious college receives a hate-filled, threatening electronic message, which states, quote, "You filthy, dirty Jew pigs need to all settle in one place so that we can annihilate you all with one nuclear blast. You will always be hated for murdering the Christian God. I would risk the flames of hell to personally herd you bastards," pardon my language, "in the gas chambers and fling your children onto bayonets." This individual was so petrified, this is at a prestigious school here in Boston, that they reported this to us, but did not want us to say anything to the school, did not want to authorize our speaking to law enforcement, was petrified to say anybody about this. It's to say anything to anyone about this. And then in the third case, which has received a lot of publicity, which many of you may be familiar with, at another local college, 13 students, members of a minority association, received electronic messages stating, quote, "BC is for white men. It included slurs against people who are Asian, Black, Hispanic, and gay. Quote, you all need to go back to where you came from." What's dangerous about an individual using hate on the Internet is that it's no longer a student. For instance, me walking up to John and saying something anti-Semitic to his face. It's not like that. In the case of with the Internet, you're able to reach a far greater audience. The hater has greater anonymity. You no longer know the identity of the person making fun of you. It's very difficult for law enforcement to track down the identity of the hater, because the ability to have greater viciousness in your messages of hate, it's easier for individuals to conspire with one another. And then most importantly, and here's to me really significant, it's much harder for the bystander to stand up and speak out against hate. And that, to me, is what's really important about tonight, is that we talk about ways as bystanders that we can speak out against hate. It's important to distinguish hate speech that does not violate First Amendment free speech rights and hate speech which contains specific actionable threat and rises to a hate crime. As we all know, the First Amendment guarantees the right to free speech, but the government may not regulate the content of internet speech to any greater degree than it can regulate free speech off the internet. But however, a hate crime is still a hate crime, even if it occurs in cyberspace. In one of the first federal prosecutions of an alleged hate crime committed on a computer network, took place at the University of California, Irvine. The comment was, quote, "All Asians should leave UC Irvine, otherwise the Asian hater will hunt all of you down and kill you." This was sent to 60 students and was found criminally actionable. The problem with the Boston College case is that law enforcement could never track down the perpetrator. I don't want to take up too much time because I think what's important is for us to be able to dialogue. I do want to spend a few minutes on possible solutions or some important questions to throw out there. One of the things that the ADL has found in our experience when we've had an increase in dealing with complaints to our office about hateful electronic messages and individuals who were victims of incidents is that when we went to law enforcement would say to us, we really want to help you, but there aren't laws out there to assist us. And we really want to help you, but we can't find the perpetrator. And schools, of course, not Murph Shapiro, because he is an example of a fabulous principal, but some other schools, and this is rightly so, schools might say to us, this took place at home. This is not our problem. It took place on a home computer by a student sending a message to another student. Internet service providers say to us, well, what can we do? You know, an internet service provider is in the business to make money. And so what ADL has done is we've marketed this filter product. The other thing that the New England Regional Office has done is we have formed a task force, and it's called a Hate on the Internet Task Force, where we have brought together for the first time prosecutors, district attorneys, law enforcement, internet service providers, internet experts, educators, students, and parents to talk about what we can do together to work on this program, to work on responding to this new phenomena. We're trying to work with parents to develop practical guides for them regarding technological and educational strategies for addressing the issue. We're distributing our publications, and we have a number of them are on the back. We have this Responding to Extremist Speech Online, 10 Frequently Asked Questions, a brochure on our site, ADL.org, and a brochure on the hate filter. With internet companies, there's the problem of individuals being kicked off one site and then one internet service provider and then just going to another one. We saw that classically with Ernst Zundel, who was mentioned in the video. How do we make it in an internet company's financial interest not to host life-threatening, hateful messages? America Online voluntarily has as one of their terms of service or rules of the road that users may not send racist or bigoted messages. What ADL has done is we've gone to AOL and we've pointed out to them that the Ku Klux Klan from Texas was hosting racist messages, and they were willing to then speak to the Klan. And the Klan was, what the Klan did is they just revised their site to turn it more into a historical revisionist, more of a history site, and say that it was their version of history to get away from the messages of hate. But as private companies, it doesn't involve government action, there's no obligation for these companies to do so. And then finally, schools, and I just want to mention briefly, private universities, as you know, are not agents of the government. So they may forbid users from enjoying offensive speech using university equipment. public universities, as agents of the government, have to follow the First Amendment prohibition against speech restrictions. Public universities can still, though, promulgate content-neutral regulations. What this means is that a public university can, for example, say that they're going to limit the computer use to academic activities only. Finally, I want to quote briefly from an article that was written by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, April 27th. And in this, he quotes Steve Case, who's the CEO of America Online. And what Thomas Friedman states is, quote, "If we are all connected and no one is in charge in cyberspace, then cultivating citizens in the schoolyard or the backyard becomes that much more important. The more the internet makes us all broadcasters, all researchers, all consumers, and alas, all potential bomb makers, the more critical it is that our teachers, parents, and communities are still making us all citizens." Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. That's a perfect lead-in for me, because I do think it's the school's responsibility, and a major one, to help educate our kids, and also to educate the parents of our kids, and also, as an evening such as tonight, to educate the community around the issues that have been touched upon. The filters, and we can talk more about them, are very important, but what we really need is conscientious citizens and conscientious kids who use the internet in a very positive way. To me, it's clear, 95% of the kids I deal with use the internet and email in a very positive and healthy way. Basically, they use the email to keep in touch with relatives and friends, friends who may live across the street or across the country. And they do a lot of research projects. The kind of things that kids are now doing in schools in 7th and 8th grade are quite remarkable. And the presentation of what they're doing and a way to communicate with us about what they're learning is quite remarkable. As important as writing continues to be and will continue to be, effective ways of getting messages across through multimedia presentations is what's going on, what will be happening, and what our kids need to know how to do. And right now, I would say that 95%, as I said, are using all of these things very well. The school limits the children's use of the internet and does not, at this point, allow any email on our school computers. And we do that through the way the computers are set up in the school so that it's easily observed what site students are visiting. We also have guidelines and rules that students are expected to follow, and if they don't follow them, they'll lose their privilege of using computers in school for periods of time. There's also an acceptable use policy that the Newton Public Schools has been developing. It has not quite been voted on by the school committee, but we are using as guidelines for our kids to give them guidance. And basically the message is that computers in schools are to be used for school-related projects, and that sites need to, that are, you may visit as sites that you need for those projects. But Lauren raised the interesting question, and one that we faced. What about kids from our school doing things that are really very unkind, mean, or possibly illegal to other kids, and then a school really being the place where that can be dealt with? Because it's not done on a school computer, does that mean the school has no right to deal in this issue? I take a more proactive approach, that if it impacts on the kids in school, then we need to deal with it. The sort of what the punishment might be is not so much the question of resolving the issue, getting the kids to realize what they're doing and what harm they might be doing and why they should not be doing that. I'm going to give you a little bit of some examples that have faced us only this year. This is the second year Oak Hill has been in existence. The first year our technology has been up and working, and there have been some issues. Lauren mentioned America Online, and that's the primary service provider and link for email and internet for most of the kids, at least in my building. And basically, a family can join America Online and have five different accesses. Five different people can have what they call usernames and passwords, so that there's basically five separate, or maybe six separate accounts. The username is what one uses to access, and then you have a password, which only that name is connected to. Now, adults, I don't know how many of you share your bank password card, but my wife doesn't know what my card password is. Kids are very, very different. Password seems to mean pass it around, and that's very, very unfortunate because they don't anticipate what that might mean for them. So too frequently, kids have access to other kids' accounts, to other kids' email, and in general, when this is given freely, it's the very close friends. But close friends don't necessarily last a lifetime when you're in seventh grade, so that by sometime later in the year, that friend may not be as close. And while they may not do anything, they're quick to share what you told them with somebody else, and pretty soon that password really becomes useless. And if people aren't savvy enough to change it, then other people access their account and begin sending email out under their name, saying some horrible things. I mean, things that you wouldn't anticipate these really nice kids would say. But I believe the anonymity, the fact that they think that they can't be traced back, it can't be traced back to them, allows them to do things that they would never do and about which they'd be terribly embarrassed and are terribly embarrassed when confronted. But this is one of the ways that AOL and actually it's any service provider, you would need a password. And unless kids are cautious about keeping that password private, then these kids, things can happen. There is an even smaller group of kids who emulate the hackers of the world. These are kids who want to find out ways to access other people's internet accounts by figuring out their password, using tools, software to break down and figure out what another person's password is and then having access to it. And we as adults, and I indicated this at the beginning, being sometimes naive, think, oh, they would never do that. Our teachers have email accounts, and they're all given a sort of a standard password at the beginning and then encouraged to personalize it. But of course, many of them didn't take the time to personalize it, thinking, what's the difference? Well, once, in our case, a kid found out what that password was and accessed the teacher's email and read email, which was referring to other students in the school. Now, we have a policy that you do not discuss students in email because of this difficulty in keeping it secure. But in this case, it was a serious problem. The school did deal directly with that. We were able to find out who did it and suspended the children involved. But the fact that they would even do that was shocking to me, and I've been a principal for 30 years. So this is a whole new world opening up, and we have to think about it and be careful about it. The issue that Lauren described as the internet hate site in which one child really was gone over brutally, what happened at our school, and the issue of, again, many service providers, in order to increase their numbers, will offer free websites and free email, and they do very little checking about who it is that they're giving this free email and free websites to. So students can develop websites putting on it almost anything. AOL may check more closely than another service provider, but the kids then can do that. And again, they share the password to access this site. So any kid in the group can put anything on it, and nobody knows who put it on, because when you trace back that password, it's back to some fictitious person and name. And to me, Lauren mentioned anonymity. To me, that is really the issue, that the kids feel that they are have a tremendous power and cannot be traced in doing this. And I think, unfortunately, because there is so much offering of free sites and free email, I mean, I'm happy with, I happen to have two accounts, one for school and one for my personal use, but kids would have 25 accounts and create all kinds of characters behind those accounts and are happy to do that and spend enormous amounts of time on it. AOL has something which is both a blessing and a curse. They have what's called an instant messenger, and what your kids are able to do is they go online and they are told automatically who in their group of friends is online at the same time. Each kid has submitted a list, and if the a friend is on, they can immediately communicate with that friend, typing back and forth instant messages. They don't have to bother to send it, have the friend read it and send back. They have a ongoing conversation. Now that may be, well, it is fine and can be fine, but it doesn't turn out to be two kids. It turns out to be 35 kids. And what happens is they all leave school and they can't wait to go home and get online so they can talk to each other after they've just spent all day together talking. Somewhat of the old phone conversation, but in this case you have, as I said, maybe 35 kids online at the same time talking. Now, one of my teachers shared with me a very positive result that a group in the same class started talking about a school project, and one kid was encouraging another kid to do a really good job on this because it was very important for the term grade. So that's the positive point. The negative point is that sometimes they get into some pretty negative stuff that grows because of the large number. Instead of two people, you have 10 people into some negative things, and oftentimes, as middle schoolers will be, it's negative about another kid. The other thing which I just learned of is, as I indicated, kids sometimes have a multiple of usernames, or they may be using someone else's name. So a kid is in conversation with another kid or with another kid they think they know, but in fact it's somebody else altogether whom they don't know. And they feel very much violated and tricked. It's a very discomforting kind of feeling. I was concerned because a group of teachers and I were talking about this, and basically we wondered whether other kids were in awe of kids doing this, or was it neat to be able to get someone else's password and get on email and pretend you're them and trick other kids. So I went to a couple of classes, and I put a continuum on the board. At one end I had "It's all right," and at the other I had "It's wrong," and then there were degrees in the middle. And I described a situation in which a child got a hold of another kid's password and did access that child's email account and read the email and passed it around to other kids. And I asked them where they would put themselves on the continuum in making a judgment about this. Was it wrong? Was it sort of okay? Or was it just fine? I'm pleased to say that most of the kids put it, there was no question, it's wrong. You do not invade others' privacy. So that message, which comes to them from outside cyberspace, is something that most of them carrying over. Some kids felt that if you were foolish enough to give up your password, or if you were not guarded enough to protect your password, then whatever the results were your responsibility. Now, those kids got a pretty good argument from the other kids, which I was pleased to see. But I do think there is in the kids' consciousness this idea, once I'm able to get that access, then it's no holds barred, and I can do whatever I want. I was told by a kid, all of this is fascinating to me, because I said at the beginning, I think the kids are a few steps ahead of all of us. There is apparently a program that you can load on your computer, and then whenever anyone else puts a password in to access any account, it keeps a record of it, and then you can find out what that person's password is. To me, that didn't make any sense because nobody uses my computer but myself. But apparently, this kid wanted to know what his mother's password was for her AOL account so he could read her mail. It turns out that she was the one that got this password detector so she could find out what passwords her sons had taken so she could find out what they were doing on the Internet. So this is a very slippery slope, but one in which we still have to keep giving a message to kids about the issues of right and wrong. I'm convinced, and no disparagement to this particular filter, but kids who want to will find ways to access what we don't want them to access. What the issue is, making them clear about what they're doing and why they're doing it. It's not that we can't make it happen, it has to be a message that it shouldn't happen. So that's really where I see the schools are. I speak for Oak Hill Middle School, not for the other schools. But it is an educational process, and that's a message that I keep repeating over and over again. We're not going to stop it technologically. What we need to do is understand it as adults and then help kids understand what their responsibilities are in using it. We have a website, the Oak Hill website, where we actually have suggestions for parents and link them to ways to keep the Internet safe for their children. And one of the sites that we link to is Internet for Parents. And so people need to take a little bit of time, look at the Internet, see what kids can access, what they might be doing, and help them understand what they shouldn't be doing and also hopefully what they should be doing. Jonathan.
Don't worry, guys, I hit it.
Maybe we can adjust the lights in some way so that's more visible. Forgive my summer cold. You may not want to come up to me afterwards and ask me any questions. I wish I went to your middle school, Merv, when I was a middle schooler, that is. It actually sounds much better the way you describe it and the leadership you describe than the one I was privileged to go to. So, good evening, everybody. I'm here to sort of sweep up some of the things that have been said so far on the panel, and I guess we cut to discussion. That's the title of the presentation, Hate on the Internet. Below that is my name and my organization, and these days we give a URL, too. That URL is the HTTP thing, cyber.law.harvard.edu. And as I say, it's not filtered by most of the software out there. that'll become clearer later. I just wanted to begin with an Instapoll of sorts. I'm curious, among the audience here, how many people have kids 18 or younger? Interesting. So a number of people are here actually curious, but not for their own kids. Of those who have kids, how many are in the 5% that really need to be watched versus the 95% that are okay? Okay, one person there. And I see. Trust no one, as they say. Yes. Does any of you actually use filtering software right now on your computers? Is any of you thinking, I don't know how, just curious as to how persuasive the video was for the ADL software. Is that something you'd get? No. Okay, might have to tweak the presentation of the video a little bit. But in any case, let me try to make some hay of that. Two things I want to talk about. First, how big is the problem generally? For those not particularly familiar with the Internet, it might be hard to sort of get your arms around the problem. When I teach this in my Internet and Society class every year, I find the best introduction to any particular class is usually the Fox 25 News at 10, which when it is not making you worry about your food or the quality of the river or air or something like that, is telling you how bad the Internet is. So I wanted to try to get our arms around just how big is the problem of hate on the Internet, and then move on to what's out there to solve it and how well does it work. And a lot of that will touch on Lauren's presentation about the ADL filter. So first, how big is the problem? And here's an example. I don't know how readable it is, but you saw some of this in the video anyway. You can walk up to Yahoo. If you don't know what Yahoo is, you really must not be Internet savvy. Not meaning to put you down at all, just saying, Yahoo is one of the first sites you're going to find if you turn on your computer and ask to surf the Internet. It's one of several so-called portals or search engines. With it, the idea is you walk up to the box that is right up here, and you type in something that interests you greatly, such as white supremacy. And you type that in and you hit search. You may have been distracted by the opportunity to win an Apple PowerBook G3, but if not, it comes back with some matches, somewhat hard to read there, but you'll see there's an entire category. Whoa. A real space danger of sorts materializing. Are you okay, sir? Okay. No casualties yet from our discussion of hate on the Internet. Okay, here you see Yahoo actually has editors who are hard at work, squadrons of college interns, barely out of high school, free of their filters. Suddenly they're crawling all over the Internet to help Yahoo categorize it. And you see there's a number of categories here under society and culture. There's cultures and groups, and under that is white pride and racialism. And under white pride and racialism, there are a number of sites here. some of which were featured on the very video that you saw from Lauren. And there's a quick snapshot of Stormfront, which is David Duke's site, has a quote of the week from Charles Lindbergh, of all people, and all sorts of other information. So to whatever extent there is stuff out there, and exactly how you'd measure the volume is unclear, whether it be in pounds or bits or something, the key thing about the internet is it brings everything far away to you in only a couple clicks. There at least is only a few clicks to going onto the computer, typing white supremacy, and getting what you asked for. Here's an example of, there was the revisionist page that you saw, again, featured in the video. Let me see. Yeah, there it is. There's the revisionist page, and not actually a whole lot of sites, only a handful. I'm sure each of these is actually blocked by the ADL filter. And then you actually see there's a category called refutation. And if you click on refutation, it actually takes you to another page, which is called Exposing Denial and Holocaust Revisionism and Neo-Nazism, sites that are much like what you would find were you to go to the ADL site and say, tell me about Holocaust revisionism. So that's Yahoo's way of sort of being neutral, but at the same time trying to give you both sides of the story, as it were. This is an example of one of the reports by one of the gentlemen that Lauren was talking about, A Layman's Guide to Holocaust Denial and the Big Lie, including such categories as gas chambers could not have been opened safely, the extermination chambers were actually morgues, possible to kill 6 million people at Auschwitz, a whole series of statements, no doubt, if you were to follow the table of contents, backed up by what passes for a series of sentences, if not outright evidence, to support the claim. This is the kind of thing that if it were on a website would try to be blocked by the filter. But realize also this particular document can also be found on something called Usenet. I don't know how many people are familiar with Usenet. Usenet is actually a public messaging system so that you are not visiting websites. You're not going to places on the internet that somebody went to the trouble of creating a website that others would view later. Instead, it's a way of joining a kind of free-for-all discussion that takes place over a period of days or even weeks. You can type in a message and push send. You can send it to a so-called news group like alt.revisionism, and others who are interested can go to alt.revisionism and see what others have written. So it's almost, you can think of it sort of like a website for which anybody can provide the content as well as go and read it. And that's another category of places where you might find such things. This is an example of an exchange that takes place over Usenet, found through a website. The two in that way can be somewhat interchangeable. Somebody posted a quotation by a Jewish partisan about the idea is, you know, nobody was noticing when we were being killed. And then there's somebody writing back, what about the 200 million victims of communism? What about the hundreds of thousands of civilian victims of Allied conventional nuclear bombs? Disgusting little hypocrite. So that was his response. And then sure enough, somebody fires off a response to him. Tell us, evil little worm, what did you do to save all the people? And then he wrote back and said, about as much as you, I suspect. So here we have sort of, in the finest of American traditions, a dialogue between citizens on issues of the day, all readable by you if you are either surfing the web and putting in the search terms. Here I put in something like Holocaust revisionism, or directly subscribe to the so-called Usenet feed of groups. And the ability to filter Usenet has a whole sort of range of problems that may not resemble trying to filter different websites. So with that quick tour, what is the problem as we've heard it today? I've at least broken it down into four categories that you see up on the screen. One is kids can see things that hurt them personally. You see your ethnicity, your religion, your beliefs ridiculed or spat upon. If you're young, it can be hard to be ridiculed. I mean, it's hard even when you're not so young. But particularly when you're young, it's no fun to have something that's near and dear to you talked down. And if you look hard enough, it may not be sailing across your screen uninvited. This is the so-called push versus pull issue. But if you're searching for it, you'll find it. If you're looking to see people that have terrible things to say about African Americans, you can find it. If you happen to be African American or somebody merely sensitive, it will offend you. A second element, kids see unreliable information that they mistakenly trust or are exposed to views that are evil but appealing. You might call that sort of the falling in with the wrong element. And certainly there's a sense that part of what it means to be mature is not to fall in with the wrong element, to be able to hear a view that is wrong or wrong-headed and know it as such and not find it appealing,
The converse, then, is to be immature is not always to know. You may think it funny when, in fact, it's offensive, or you may think it persuasive when, in fact, it's offensive. So another worry, if there is such, about kids having unfettered access to the net, given that there are such extreme views available out there, certainly more extreme than what you would find surfing your television stations or even your cable television stations, do you worry that your kids are going to see things that they'll mistakenly believe, or even that they will come to, as a view or an opinion, hold themselves, even though it's wrong? And that's what I take to be the idea behind the ADL filter when it says, okay, you wanted to go see the white supremacy site, we're not going to show that to you lest it convince you. Instead, we're going to show you the other side of the argument, since you do seem to have some interest in the topic. A third problem, kids can be authors in the space, perhaps anonymously, and, being kids, generate material that is hurtful and specific to peers. That was a little bit what we heard from Merv. Kids can get onto the internet, they can create a website, or through their chat rooms or such, just say nasty things about other kids, and then when you're looking to find out who did it, there's no way to know because they are safely cloaked by the anonymity of the net. And finally, a fourth category that we didn't really talk about today, and that, at least personally in my experience, I would phrase as the least of the problems. It's the gravest if it materializes, but it's the least risk, actually. And that is, kids can encounter unsavory people virtually, and then maybe somehow in real space, too. You may have seen a recent Fox 25 News at 10 feature by which a Fox 25 reporter, pretending to be a 13-year-old, was able to encounter a 25-year-old guy pretending to be a 13-year-old, and they then agreed to meet to have sex, but instead met to produce a news segment on old men that meet reporters pretending to be women. So, all right, so that's the problem. Then you might say, all right, how big is the problem? As I've already said, give me units and I can try to answer. I'm not sure what the units are. I mean, it's the kind of thing for which you'd say, if only one kid has feelings hurt or is persuaded to hold racialist, that's I guess what they call it, racist tendency views, that's one too many. But of course, for any given problem, you want to know how do you scale a solution that suits the problem. And I don't know. It's hard to actually say. The stuff is out there. Kids can stumble upon it. Certainly, if they're looking for it, they may well find it. Just how bad that is a good question. The second thing I want to highlight is you ought to define it as a problem with respect to what ages. Certainly, there may be kids sufficiently young for which if they go onto the net and just find out that there, in fact, is no Santa Claus, it will actually hurt them gravely. They've been told by the parents that there is a Santa Claus. That's actually a case where they might believe something that's true that could hurt them. As they get older, you hope that what they're developing are so-called critical faculties, the ability to actually look at a website and not just take it as handed down off the mountain, but be able to critique it as they see it, or see it and then search for other websites that help them triangulate to the information. If they are searching, chances are they're not just going to look at one site, they're going to look at several, and among them may seem a variety of views, and realize then, as perhaps we come to learn in this postmodern world, it's hard to find truth. There are lots of varieties of it, and you do your best to triangulate either between the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald or one website and another as to what's actually true. Certainly, though, for very young kids, that's a hard faculty to ask that they've developed, and keeping them away from stuff that could just shock or hurt them may well be something you'd want to do. And again, I would ask the question, maybe you should be keeping away from the computer, not just away not just into the computer and hoping that the filter will do most of the hard work for you. I should say quickly, too, there are some sites, this is getting into solutions, so-called kiddie corrals, for which the assumption is that you don't get to see stuff, and then they only put stuff into the playpen that is suitable for you. And again, for very young children, this may make sense. They can walk around, they can see Barney, they can see the Teletubbies, they can go back and see Barney, and then they're done. Okay. You might imagine that it might be good for parents to have filtering software that actually excludes Barney and Teletubbies, even if they explicitly ask for it. Okay, so other solutions that we've heard a little bit about this evening. One is filtering software. Stop kids from seeing the Internet's full range of speech. The idea, to put it in its most favorable light, might be to make the offerings of the Internet, have them better approximate that which you'd find here in the Newton Library. You have a gatekeeping function going on by the librarian for which Stormwatch magazine is not on the regular subscription list. It is not placed out on the table for people to look at. Is it censorship? Yes. Is it that which we want to have in our community library? Most people would say yes. So the idea would be to have the filter be a proxy for the librarian of sorts. A second element is watch the kids more closely. What is a way by which, when the kid is surfing in the privacy of his or her own bedroom, you could come in later and at least try to figure out what the kid has been looking at, and if it's something unsavory, do the appropriate intervention for the parent. I see you've been interested in David Duke. Is there something we need to talk about? That kind of thing. What I call here is the power of the panopticon. Not only is it a way that you can know what your kid is up to and thereby intervene as appropriate, but if the kid knows that you know, that alone is enough to make the kid behave a little differently. And the panopticon is the classic structure of the so-called modern prison, by which the warden can sit in the center, and there's sort of a rotating view of hallways that point to all the cells. And the people in the cells never know if the warden is even home or looking, but the fact that there's a clear line of sight is enough to make them choose to behave better. So that's another sort of category of solution. A third category is the critical thinking skills I was talking about. Is there a way in which Pandora's box is open? You just can't believe in Santa Claus as long as you used to. Part of growing up and becoming 7 years old is actually learning that there are bad people in the world. They have virulently hateful views. They are far away, but they need to be accounted for. Of course, that's an ideological question as to how you want to raise your kid that I don't pretend to tell you what to do. So here's a quick look at the first category of stuff, the filtering software. This is one called Cyber Patrol. Am I right that Cyber Patrol is the company that does the ADL hate filter? So it's sort of a niche product for the Cyber Patrol people. They have the Cyber Not Block list. And as many high school or college interns are slaving away trying to categorize things for Yahoo, if you don't get a job doing that, the other job you'll get is slaving away categorizing things for Cyber Patrol. So as quickly as Yahoo is listing the crap, you are listing it as well so that it can't be found by the site. Now, you may wonder, what does Cyber Patrol actually block? That's a good question. Cyber Patrol believes that is a trade secret. They don't want to have the list released, otherwise all the hard work, the sweat of the brow of the interns could be copied by Cyber Schmutrol, which would take the list and offer a cheaper product. So as a result, you don't know what they're blocking until you actually try to surf the site and find that it is blocked. That may mean that if you are somebody like the Harvard Law School Center for Internet and Society, it's hard to know whether you've been blocked. Perhaps we've mistakenly put pornography on our front page, or at least the word sex. Perhaps we've had a forum called Sex and Kids about Cyber Patrol and other issues, and we're blocked by some software. There's not an easy way for us to know that we've been blocked, and that has led to some issues. But here at least are some rough categories offered by Cyber Patrol. And if you're a parent configuring the software, you actually can go along each category and say whether you want to include it or not. Categories include violence, profanity, partial nudity, full nudity, sexual acts, gross depictions. I don't know, some of these are subsets of others, I suppose. Intolerance, satanic and cult, drugs and drug culture, militant extremists, sex education, questionable, illegal, and gambling, alcohol, and tobacco. So again, if you're an intern, you have a lot of work to do to actually figure out whether a given site hits all of these on the nose. I assume there are a couple sites out there that, akin to Carlin's Seven Dirty Words Act, actually try to hit everything and consider it a badge of honor if they do, or if it falls only into a couple of the categories. Here's a different kind of software, this one from Birch Tree Systems, that will be the kind of thing that is just the log. It monitors where the computer has been, and when you get back, you can basically examine the tire treads and see if the kid has departed from the highway. The primary customers for these kinds of software, as you might see from the paragraph up there, is the workplace. Birch Tree Systems has a wonderful ad, which I wish I had scanned in. It's a picture of a salacious sort of, I don't know what you would call it, woman dressed salaciously, and it says, this is what your employees are looking at for most of the day, don't you want to know, and lets you set up the panopticon for your employees. And as they play solitaire or look at pornography, they never know if the boss is watching or is in fact herself playing solitaire or looking at pornography. It would be interesting, actually, if as the boss you had to allow reciprocity so that your employees could look at whatever you were doing at any given moment. So anyway, this is part of their frequently asked questions, in which they say, of course it's not unfair or illegal to monitor people. It's your property. It's your company. Why should you lose the productivity that comes from letting people surf the net? And this is another one called Little Brother. I don't know why it's not called Big Brother. It's called Little Brother. But it's a combination of both. It tells you who uses the internet, what sites the user goes to, whether each site is productive or not. I don't know what the interns who rate productivity. And a whole bunch of other things. And at the end, you'll see internet sites are rated and categorized, and they're a way that you can try to specify rules to block access to, that's right, unproductive sites. And the third category of solution, this is just a column by Thomas Friedman in a series that Lauren referenced, in which he's saying, okay, the internet's here to stay, the tech stuff isn't going to work, you just have to sit down with your kids and have them educate you as you're educating them about their use of the internet. Let me just run through a couple quick problems with the blocking, the filtering software. Problem number one is it is readily routed around much more easily by your kid than by you. This is from a site called peacefire.org, which is blocked by, I believe, every filtering product. And it's run by a guy named Bennett Hazelton, great guy. You would want him for your son. He is actually, I think, in college right now, maybe just graduated high school. And here is his site, how to determine what sensorware is installed on your machine. And you just click on the particular software, and it will tell you how to disable it. It is amazingly easy to do so. Here's just the beginning of CyberSitter 97. Here's how you know that it's installed. And then once that happens, here's how you go ahead and disable it. And indeed, here's a little, I know you might see banner ads when you surf the web. Here is a banner ad that Bennett offers so that people visiting his site from an unfiltered computer can paste that onto their website. And in that little banner ad is the two commands you need to issue to Windows to disable CyberSitter 97. He does it as a graphic so that CyberSitter, which in addition to blocking sites, is known to put in X's. It substitutes X's for words that are stop words, such as jerk or bastard or even worse. It will substitute X's for those words. In order that it not substitute X's for the phrase, how to disable CyberSitter, he does it as this graphic. And in the graphic, you can't tell what's a word and what's a picture. It's a picture of a word. So it's a very clever way of getting around the X machine. Another problem with the sensorware or filtering software, depending on what you'd like to call it, is that it can sometimes filter out stuff you really wouldn't want to have filtered. As a parent, you're often making one decision at the time you configure the software, and then all other decisions are relegated to your proxy, the person that actually runs the filtering software. This is an example of a course jointly taught between MIT and Harvard Law School, with which I confess some affiliation, readings on computer communications and freedom of expression. This site is actually filtered by several of the filtering programs because it in turn links to things that talk about how to disable filtering software. This is a neat little quotation from a guy named Mark Rotenberg showing what the First Amendment might look like if the XXX blocking software were installed. It removed the PEE from speech, it took the ASS out of assemble, and it got rid of the TIT and petition for the government. Now, this is somewhat a cheap shot because, of course, it looks for a space in between each one. It's only if you misspell P and say P that it would really take it out. But it was enough of a funny cheap shot that I thought I would include it today. Another site that is filtered out by many sites, it's funny that Lauren's presentation, the movie, mentioned anti-gay sites as part of the hate on the internet. Of course, it is all in the eye of the beholder. Part of the freedom of filter is some people want to filter out homosexuality to protect their children from any discussion of same. So here's an example of a site, a Stop AIDS t-shirt, Keith Haring design, that's filtered out, and if you were to tick the box that said homosexual-related things or have a particular kind of filter, it would in fact filter this out. And indeed, you sometimes, there's another site that's been filtered that relates to gay rights. This is Jewish Community. Jewish.com is filtered out by several sites because the personals section can be very personal. Some people enjoy more than just long walks on the beach, and that's enough to earn Jewish.com a blacklist. So again, it does get kind of recursive as people battle to filter each other out. And indeed, filteringfacts.org is one of the prime pro-filtering sites. It is filtered on the basis of intolerance by Cyber Patrol, and there's a huge battle going on between the two where they're saying, how dare you filter us, the king of the filters, for being intolerant. Another example, NARAL.org, a very common candidate for filtration among these pieces of software. It also raises the issue, I mean, generally we're talking about empowering parents to help raise their kids. You do wonder, though, at what level of empowerment you do want. How much ought the parent, as a policy matter, to be empowered? Of course, among the parents in the room, the answer may be clear all the way. But you do wonder, for those parents who don't want their kids learning about choice, if you happen to be pro-choice, you may find yourself wanting to root for the kid in routing around the parent rather than routing, being the parent and hoping that you can control the kid. So all that being said, what's my solution? I don't know. I usually just say it's very complicated and requires further study, so please give me a grant. But since I'm not in an audience, I think that I'm able to do that. I'll actually come clean a little bit. First, with respect to the problems we see with surfing, these are the problems that have to do with kids seeing things that will offend them, things that may influence them unduly and that are bad. I don't like filters. I don't think it really helps, and I do think, just as an empirical matter, they are just too easily hacked away by students, and students will dedicate their time honing their computer science skills, which will put them in good stead later for college, but in the meantime, they will tend to get around it. So maybe they'll come up with a filter that can't be gotten around, but they haven't yet. And most of your kids can do it, I assure you, or can befriend the kid who can. So there's a new site actually called Third Voice, which is very interesting. And this is now vaulting all of you, if you're not already there, to the cutting edge of cyberspace studies. This Third Voice site came about, I think, just a couple weeks ago. Here it is. Third Voice is a software by which you look at a site, and then when you look at it, if you're running Third Voice, it tells you if others who have looked at it before you have a comment or two to add. So there's a little wedge with a circle around it there, and the wedge shows you that others before you that were just merely reading the site left behind a kind of idea dropping, an idea dropping that you can look at. And the idea dropping, then when you click upon it, expands, and you see here's a comment from John Doe about that aspect of the site. Now you can imagine, actually, this gives, to the extent that Lauren was talking about, let me just jump back to the other screen here. Lauren was talking about we all need to be more active bystanders. This is actually a wonderful opportunity for all of the interns at the ADL that are working to go ahead and go through to these hate sites and place their comments in. And then you actually can imagine your kids seeing the site and seeing the wedges and being able to see the debate going back and forth. Of course, similarly, it might mean that people can come to the ADL site and give their own comments. It's going to be a world in which ideas flow freely. This is the main benefit of the internet as we know and love it, and the main fear as we worry about kids getting exposed to that exchange too early. The other benefit of it is there's no lock to pick. It's not something that's meant to prevent the kid from going where she wants. It's an opportunity where the kid actually gets to see a good fight. I mean, this turns, in a way, a hate site into a talk show. I mean, it's now Oprah, and they get to see the interplay going back and forth, a fight that appeals. I mean, kids like Jerry Springer, this is, in a sense, a debate going back and forth on the ideas. So they may actually even find it appealing to see both sides rather than just look at one. So that is a potential solution, a mere 2 weeks old, that could emerge to help address the problem in a way that doesn't have you having to try to padlock your kid's computer. Third Voice may get sued out of existence in the next few weeks as companies worried that people are actually going to say, you know, that product was really crappy, as their comment on the product website, try to get it banned or abolished. I'll be teaching a session on Third Voice this fall, no doubt. The other question was sort of the anonymity question, and that gets back to your kids as authors, your kids actually creating material that's hurtful to other kids and doing it in a way for which they're not accountable. Because if you make a kid sufficiently accountable, they are highly sensitive to a rap on the knuckles or a shunning or whatever your favorite way of parenting is. It's just a question of catching them at it. And I was interested to see that Merv phrased the problem in a way of anonymity and pseudonymity as kids can't keep a secret to save their lives. You give them their password and say, don't give it to anybody, and they promptly give it out to their 20 closest friends who do the same, and before you know it, somebody is spoofing them, using their name to say something about somebody else. I say that actually cuts both ways. Kids can't keep a secret to save their lives, and therefore, even though the software may guarantee them anonymity, they can't help but blab about their feet, did you see what I did to Joey? And inevitably, it might come back into the principal's office through good old-fashioned policing tactics that don't entail actually cyber eavesdropping, and then it's a lesson learned. Even in my old middle school, long before we had an internet there, Mr. DeFeo's grade book was stolen by Eugene O. He actually got to see all the grades and comments about all the kids. And after he also had flushed someone's clarinet mouthpiece down the toilet and stolen Miss Maddox's paycheck, he was finally discovered. All three crimes, I believe, were rightfully attributed to him, and he was sent to another middle school. So, again, I suggest that there are some ways that, as these problems come up, inevitably working with teaching, shepherding kids, they're going to screw up. They're going to find ways to screw up despite how much you blunt their knives with which they cut, conceptual knives, that is, and having a way of having them have to be accountable becomes the learning experience for everybody. So with that said, I'm done, and maybe we should open it to discussion. And we can surf live if there's actually real demos you want to see. I don't know if we should bring up the lights or. People can put comments on anything they see, but realize it's not like graffiti on a wall, because it's only seen by those who say, I want to see the graffiti that somebody may have put on the wall, which gets into wonderful legal issues as to, is it a copyright violation, which, again, the lawsuit's already been filed saying that it is, because it's making a derivative work of the site. So in a way, it's almost like being able to request a transparency through which you can view the world, opting to see what others have said about it. Or I don't know if you've seen, your kids certainly have if you haven't, a show called Mystery Science Theater 3000. It actually is on television. It shows old meatball B-rated science fiction flicks and has a silhouette of people watching it as if in a movie theater, and you hear their commentary, which is very funny, as the movie unfolds. So in a way, it's a Mystery Science 3000, but you have to say, I want to watch the silhouettes, not I'm just generally out surfing the sites. Correct. Until you say, I'm installing third voice and I'd like to hear that third voice. That's right.
Well, we do that not in a limiting sense, but teachers will go out and pre-surf and find sites for the kids so they don't spend an inordinate amount of time, you know, using a keyword and then ending up with 4,000 sites and trying to select out of it. So we do it that way. We haven't dealt with it in the limiting way, although I do believe there are some, I know that AOL, for example, limits certain sites by age. If a parent puts in the age of the child, then certain sites will not be available. But you're taking a much more positive point of view on that, and that's something for us to explore. I don't know if anyone is doing that, Kathy.
One of the things we're doing at the library is
Well, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to get teachers to agree on exactly those sites, but I would agree with you that it's certainly a good start. Our website, the librarian, has created a number. He knows what the curriculum is within the various grades, so he has developed, again, a series of sites, not to limit, really, but to give kids more focus instead of thinking that they're going to surf the entire Internet. Paul?
Yeah, it can. I mean, this is the so-called kiddie corral. It's just a really big kiddie corral. So it develops collaboratively among different teachers. You may not be able to stop kids from hacking around it, but assuming a kid that just doesn't have a lot of computer aptitude, you can pretty much keep them penned in. Then it just regresses to the question of what's the role of the Internet in the education of the child? And if part of what your kid in the information economy 15 years, 20 years hence is going to need to be doing is sifting through big piles of information such as the net is today and learning to discriminate among it and sift it to actually try to recreate that sampler's world of, look, it's Encyclopedia Britannica, it's all neatly laid out, may not be doing the kid a service. But that's something for an educator, I guess, to make that trade-off, as you say, about. I just wanted to throw out here. Yeah.
Also, I was going to be spoken about how, you know, it's important for parents to be involved in teaching values for their children.
Right.
The Internet, I don't want to say it's no different than any other form of information, but it is different because there's a lot more available to everyone. But I mean, it's still a resource where children need to learn appropriate rules for use and then need to learn to use critical thinking skills to decide what's good and what's bad.
Right. I just wanted to quickly show, and then I have a URL from Merv to show. I was reminded by a kiddie crowd. This is whitehouse.gov. It's the White House. If you go to whitehouse.com, it is a very famous, because it's whitehouse.com, porn site. And indeed, they trumpet at the top here. This White House has been featured on ABC News, CNN, CNET, blah, blah, blah. And here's this little, you must be 18 years or older to enter this site. That's just sort of an admonition rather than a verifiable statement. And there's actually a way you can do a search. I wish I knew the vocabulary of the search engine knowledge. You can actually find out how many websites in the .edu or .us zone, which means generally schools, have as part of their links for the White House, whitehouse.com by mistake. And it actually pulls up a ton of links of teachers pulling together resources that, you know, you just hit com because that's where everything is. Having
hit Rome. Yes. We don't say them, though.
Well, no, they figure out.
Well, it's
so here it is, the Oak Hill Middle School. And here's a bunch of links to safety on the net.
And then if you click the picture, I was just thinking the library.
Any particular
The library.
Oh, that's yeah. Right here?
Yeah. Just sort of in response to, I don't know if you can call it. And there should be resources.
I see a list of links. Would that be it?
Yeah. Oh, there we go. And those are for teachers and kids in order to access different areas.
person?
Yes.
This is a bit of a different subject, but one of the most disturbing parts of all the state of the internet is the recipes for bombs and the ingredients that you need to make bombs. And my question is, from a First Amendment point of view, isn't this in the big part of someone analogous to yelling fire in a crowded theater? I mean, isn't there some way legally that you could get at least that small segment of information off the internet?
You can try. You can certainly point to a core of stuff for which it just seems it has no business being there. Some will point out quite quickly that the U.S. Forest Service will actually, on request, send you a pamphlet on how to mix ammonium nitrate to properly blast your trees over. And anybody can send away for it. And there's the government telling you how to make a bomb. Well, this is true. So, yeah, I suppose that's true, but it's a tough row to hoe, because it's not going to be static, it's not going to be websites that you can find and then target. It'll float around on that Usenet that I was describing before by email. And you might say, well, the fact that it's still out there doesn't mean you shouldn't take a stand against it. But you do want to wonder how effective the stand can be before really investing in it, and figure, all right, well, maybe we just need better controls on ammonium nitrate rather than, you know, when it enters the physical, rather than just on the information.
And I just want to respond to that by saying that there is some consideration of legislating that issue in terms of intent, that if you can show that the bomb making is specifically for the intent of going after an individual with a biased motivation. Right now in, I think, something like over 30 states, there's anti-paramilitary training statutes where people who go out and play, if you can show that somebody goes out to play soldier in the woods with the intent to overthrow the government, then that's illegal, which is different from just going out to play soldier in the woods. Right, but that's what crosses, that the question is whether it crosses the line into insightful speech.
Yeah. Do I need to advise you of your Fifth Amendment rights at this point? Sorry, go ahead. Well, but indeed, too, the part of the law that Lauren's talking about is one that doesn't punish the user of the information, it's the supplier. I mean, it's going to go after the person who actually places it on the internet. And so you have to look to the intent of the person placing it on the internet. And at least the current way it's phrased, it does raise some concerns about whether it's only going to catch the, you know, military insurrectionist who puts the information up. It may well catch the chemistry professor who knows quite well that that site's going to get hits from search engines that, you know, are from people that have no good in mind. But here's the press release about that.
One of the things that strikes me is that kids have connections to sites and people. I mean, parents know what's in a chemistry book pretty much. They went through it and know the level at which a kid might become fascinated and involved. It seems to me that on the internet it goes far beyond that, and that kids in their very positive kind of inquisitiveness may end up in areas that are far bigger and far more dangerous than we would imagine. And again, that's why I encourage, let's make sure we as adults know what's, at least have a sense of what's out there, where they may be visiting. Not stop them necessarily from visiting, but at least having a sense of that and being able to educate them about it. That's the piece that scares me, that they're getting in touch with things that they wouldn't be able to get in touch with before, and we haven't learned yet how to educate them. They're getting there earlier than we
we ever imagined.
Well, I think that's something that we do. One of the things that we do here at the library is actually something that the American Library Association doesn't do. We don't promise even private access to the internet. We provide them with access to the internet. They're all in very public areas. There's librarians walking back and forth. There's members of the public. They don't put private use things. We don't provide people with private access to the internet. And I don't think parents should provide their children with private access to the internet. It's inappropriate to know what your kids are looking at. A woman says to me, like, you know, my kids in this room for hours every night on the internet, and I don't know what he's doing. And I said to her, you need to know what he's doing. I mean, that's, if he was watching television, would you let him watch television for hours every night? You have no idea what he's watching. Even worse, everybody says it's okay to look at television. And then all of a sudden, I just heard something where when psychologists went to Milton and they interviewed parents said they felt it was inappropriate that they were invading their children's privacy because they watched what they were looking at on the internet. So, I mean, you know, that, what did you call it? Was that Panopticon or whatever?
Panopticon?
Panopticon. It's like you want kids to think you have eyes in the back of your head.
Although again, it cuts both ways. As soon as you vault from kids to adults, you tell me the public library in Utah, where somebody who is among the 50% of people who get their net access through a library and only through a library, wants to look up gay rights and sees the community seeing him as he does it. I mean, it cuts both ways for adults.
Yes.
Well, the middle and high schools have a basic same policy. And that's, as I said, we have an acceptable use policy, which spells out what kids can use computers for, and particularly the internet and email. And that, in fact, is, as I said, is being reviewed, at, I understand it, by this, the city's solicitors to make sure that everything in it is appropriate, and then it will be passed by the school committee and be in effect in September. So that will guide all the schools. There's some latitude in it, but it will be system-wide. And for all levels, although the secondary has some more specific punishments and penalties than anyone who abuses those rules. Well, basically not being allowed to use school computers and for either short or long periods of time. Dennis?
Well, John, probably the idea that being anonymous, I know that if you're going through some ISP, the service provider, sometimes they can go back and search and find out who was accessing it at the time. Are they really going to be anonymous, or is it more of how much cooperation you can get from the ISP?
At the moment, right now, it's an arms race, which is to say, if you have somebody going to great lengths to be anonymous and somebody not going to great lengths to uncover them, the anonymous person wins. On the other hand, somebody not particularly worried about anonymity or only doing a little bit to secure it against somebody very determined to find out who they are, that person loses. And then what happens when you have the irresistible force, meaning the immovable object, is a toss-up. Louis Free, among others, wants to see legislation passed that would, for example, require internet service providers to have caller ID on their incoming modem pools so they know what phones are placing calls to the modem and then can trace from there what internet sites are being visited by the person that called that modem. And in the end, you could trace back to a physical house or a telephone, at least, somebody doing something. It hasn't gone anywhere yet, but again, I see that arms race is going to shake out over the next couple of years one way or the other. My guess is it's going to be increasingly difficult to be anonymous. And understanding everything I just said about how kids are always going to find a way around it, when it comes down to anonymity over the next couple of years, I actually don't believe that. I believe that for all but a couple wizards who won't share their skills, and for which it will be illegal for them to share their skills, we will be quite knowable on the net. And the only thing may be there'll be some process before it's known. Somebody has to get a warrant somewhere or lodge a civil suit and serve a subpoena.
but with the right process, they're going to find out who you are.
How does that tie in, though, even if you want to get to the U.S., if someone's to be a service provider,
it depends. I mean, the United States is still the leader, and you want to be interoperable. If there were some way in which, you know, Bahrain wasn't going to be compatible with our next generation internet if they don't, you know, adhere to certain protocols, Bahrain will fall into line. The other thing is that there may be a common interest among governments, Bahrain particularly among them, to be able to know who their callers are rather than the other way around. There's a wonderful, if you go to the Saudi Arabian country code website run by the Saudi government, if you actually hook up through a Saudi internet service provider, which the only ones there are ones approved by the government, it must subscribe to filtering software. So everybody is automatically filtered according to the software that the Saudi government has set up. And there's a wonderful entry, maybe I'll find it in the next couple minutes, on the Saudi site, suggest a site to block. And you know, you suggest the site, and the reason why, I click submit, says thank you, we try to get to all requests within 24 hours. You know, recruiting people to help find sites worthy of being blocked for the whole country. And somehow he kept finding them. There's a certain zen to the whole thing where once your computer starts crashing, you got to throw it out and just get a new one. I mean, you know, it's just, you uninstall, you reinstall, more memory. Oh yeah. Yeah. Say again, I was just finding the Saudi site.
Still working on the Saudi site. The Berkman Center, I think, is going to post the
video
text of the evening's presentation on their website, which is your URL.
Yes, and let me just put that up on the screen. I'm mere moments away from having the Saudi site up there. Yeah, but let me... it'll be at cyber.law.harvard.edu. Which is the homepage for the Berkman Center. .edu, that's right. And apparently we're hiring. Maybe there's a pink slip on my chair, I don't know. Better get back to the office.
Another peril of the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes, well. Thanks very much. You know what, it must be in policies. There we are. You can use this form to send your suggestion. So, if you have a friend's site you don't like, yeah, exactly.
You are incredible. You just are. You did a great presentation. And we're really, you know, you're fast.